I'm Joe Wood, and I believe.
California, November 1896. A series of newspaper stories document a number of reports of mystery airships that continued into 1897. Most of the sightings are at night and describe slow-moving lights in the sky flashing various colors. The few daytime sightings describe a cigar-shaped object. Some reports even claim to see humanoid crew members. Popular belief at the time was that the airships were the work of an inventor of the day. That led Thomas Edison to issue a strong denial of any involvement. What is clear? In the 1890s, there are no officially recorded sightings of a man-made flying machine anywhere on Earth. Reputable observers noted at the time it would have been impossible, not to mention irrational, to keep such a thing secret.
Welcome to Alien Nation, the show about extraterrestrials and UFOs, asking the question, are we alone? In Alien Nation, I talk to other Earthlings about their otherworldly encounters, and we love hearing your stories, so please get in touch. I'll tell you how to do that at the end of the show. My guest today is the founder of Flying Disc Press, and is a widely regarded UFO researcher here in the UK. Welcome to Alien Nation, Philip Mantle.
Hello, Joe. How are you, love?
Oh, it was nice. It's nice to speak to you. I just want to ask you all about, getting involved, how you got involved in UFO research.
Yeah, I mean, I've been involved a long time now, Joe. I mean, go back to my days at school, really.
Yeah.
I mean, my mum was from a very rural part of Northern Ireland. And I remember as a young lad, she told me the story of she met a fairy down by the stream on the land they had.
Did she? I love stories like
that.
Yeah,
and it was a little pretty fairy with the wings and everything, and she conversed with it. And I asked her down the years, was this real, Mum? And she always said, well, it seemed real to me, son. And she told my children the same story. So as a young lad, I was always interested in what you call all things paranormal, Joe.
Yeah.
And I read a couple of things about UFOs, and that kind of got me really intrigued. And then, of course, in 1978, we had the Steven Spielberg movie Close Encounters hit the big screens. So I think that had an effect. And then I left high school at 16, no qualifications, didn't really know what to do. And I had a couple of jobs, and then I started reading a little bit more about it. And so when I was 20, I went to work overseas for a short while. And I was working in Germany, couldn't speak the language, but I could still get books sent from home. Now, when I came home, this was 1979. My auntie, who lived around the corner, she brought me the local evening newspaper, and it had a little advertisement for the Yorkshire UFO Society that was holding a meeting that Sunday in Leeds. So back in those days, of course, on a Sunday, Joe, there was nothing open. There's no buses. But I managed to find this place in Leeds. And it was organized by two brothers, Mark and Graham Birdsall. They'd already been involved in UFO research for a number of years. And I just felt completely at home. They put on a presentation, and I rather naively thought to myself, well, you know, I'll ask a couple of questions, I'll read a few books and magazines, and hey presto, I will have all the answers. But here I am, 40 years later, still looking for those answers, Joe. So that's how I got involved, a long time ago now.
So did you ever see a UFO or have any UFO experience, or was it just purely fascination for the whole subject?
No, we were quite lucky because in the early 1980s, there were areas in and around the market town of Skipton in the Yorkshire Dales, particularly an area called Carlton Moor. They had a lot of sightings, Joe, and when I say a lot, I mean a lot. And most of them came our way by whatever means. So occasionally we would drive up onto the moors on a night and see if we could observe the sightings that were taking place. So one evening, I think it was about 1981, I didn't drive at that point, but Graham Birdsall called me, said, shall we go on to the moors for an hour? So okay. Took us about 90 minutes to get there, and we were parked up on Carlton Moor. On the area that we looked at, Joe, there was no dwellings, no street lights. I mean, absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
And it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. We're just getting ready to pack up and go home when a little light appeared in the distance. And I said to Graham, well, that's peculiar because there's no buildings there. So Graham jumped in the car. He used to drive like a madman anyway. So we took off across the moors. And at one point, I can't remember whether it was the dry stone wall had fallen down or whether it was a dip in the road or a gate, but I could actually see right down the valley where we were. And there was just this huge cartwheel of lights is the best way I can describe it. If you look at the London Eye on an eye when it's all lit up,
yeah,
it was like that, but hanging in the sky, but multicoloured, and it was just there.
Yeah.
And we drove around the moor for an hour, seeing if we could see anything else, but not a thing. And it was the most amazing thing you've ever seen. Mm. And Graham was as angry as he could be because he didn't see it, because he had his eyes on the road because it was pitch black. And that confirmed to me there and then, Joe, that, you know, we weren't wasting our time in researching this phenomena. You know, I'd seen it with my own eyes.
How fabulous. That sounds like a really interesting one, a one that looks like, you know, that was like a cartwheel of lights. How beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing there to account for it. There is no dwellings there. There's a small village a bit further on, but, you know, this was in January. There was no fireworks. There was nothing to explain it whatsoever. Yeah. We've been in that area many, many times during the daylight hours, you know, with absolutely nothing. But it was at a time and a location where a lot of sightings were being reported to us, and we'd attempted to you know, get up close and personal before, but this was the only time we'd ever managed it.
And you saw it.
Well, yeah, and Graham was cursing and swearing, and the more I told him about it, the angrier he got, you know. But that's just the way it was.
I wonder if they still have sightings there now.
To the best of my knowledge, they do. What we did one year, I think it was 1980, mid-80s, we actually parked our caravan on the top of the moors and stayed in it for a whole week.
Yeah.
But the reason was to encourage others to come forward. And they did. We did some local media, and people came from all around the area. And what we found, Joe, that whatever was happening at that time wasn't anything new. It had repeatedly happened down the decades, you know, because people had lived and worked there, you know, man and boy, father and son, and so on. And so the sightings went back decades. So I've no reason to believe, although the frequency of them has dimmed, but we still do get occasionally sightings from those areas. For whatever reason, now and again, there is a peak in observations or a peak in sightings. Why that is, I have no idea. Then it tails off again. So, you know, but we still do get reports from those areas, I can assure you.
Yeah. It's funny how they peak, and I wonder why it is that they come at certain times and you know, and peak and then go down, and wonder what they're looking for,
I mean, yeah. You know, there are areas around the world where this happens. It's not just in the Yorkshire Dales. It's a place in Norway, for example, in central Norway, called Hessdalen.
Yeah, I've heard about that place.
Yeah, it's just a valley. And I've been there, and you don't want to go there in the winter, Joe, I can assure you. There's only a few hundred people live in the entire region, and it's surrounded by three mountains, the names of which I'd never be able to pronounce in 1,000 years, you know. But they have these sightings. When I say in the valley, I mean in the valley, below the mountaintops. So, you know, and originally they borrowed and begged some equipment to record it, which they did. But now, you know, 30 years on from when they first appeared, they now have a permanent monitoring base.
Yeah.
The latest technology, and it's been caught on camera and so on. And that, again, has, you know, peaks in frequency, and then it tails off. And that's just another example. And there's other areas like that around the world.
Now, yeah. I want to ask you about the alien autopsy hoax.
Right.
Yes. So that film, a bit of film that I've seen where they're doing that autopsy on an alien. So that is a hoax?
Oh, absolutely. I mean...
Oh, shame. I thought it was... For years, well, I've thought that was true.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are others that believe it's true. And it goes way back to 1993. And at that point, I was the press officer for the British UFO Research Association. And I did other things for them as well. And I had a letter on my desk, came from a gentleman called Ray Santilli, who run a company, called the Merlin Group. And his initial letter was asking if we could help assist with the making of a UFO documentary, just very general. So I wrote back. This is the days before email and all that kind of stuff. You had to write.
Yeah.
And after a couple of letters, I spoke to him on the phone and we talked a bit. And then out of the blue, he says, well, Philip, he says, I've actually got film of the UFO crash at Roswell and the creatures being autopsied.
Oh, my God.
So I just said, show me. You know, it's a great story on the end of a phone, but show me. So I met him not that long after this in London. We used to have sort of monthly meetings and lectures in London. I invited him along to one. Ray Santilli told me, you know, this story of being in Cleveland, Ohio in 1992, looking for old film of Elvis and things like that, you know, before they were famous. This was part of his business that he ran. It was mainly music he was involved in. And he said he bought a piece of Elvis footage from some old boy. And before coming home, this old boy said, well, look, before I was a freelance cameraman, I was in the military and I filmed the UFO crash at Roswell and I've got some film. So Ray bought it. He said, paid cash, no questions asked, shook hands. So again, I said, show me. So it was, yes, I can. No, I can't. Yes, I can. Cut a long story short. He eventually showed me the film in 1995. And at that point, I was also the association's conference organizer. So when I saw it, I just said, Ray, why don't you show this at our conference? I've got one organized for August 1995 in Sheffield. And to my amazement, he said, yes, he agreed. The story eventually got out. You know, we went around the world. You know, Fox made the major documentary on it in the US. And it was the most controversial thing you could ever wish to see. You know, the battle lines were drawn and I was right in the middle of it all. But slowly but surely, Ray's story, you know, began to unfold. You know, we found chinks in his armour. And it became personal for me because one idiot even accused me of being his accomplice, you know, that I was involved in it somehow. To cut a long story short, after a lot of work and investigation, came upon a gentleman called Spiros Malaris. Spiros has got several strings to his bow, one of which he is a magician. He's also a filmmaker, an artist, and a whole host of other things. And it was Spiros and a small team that actually faked the whole thing.
Oh, my God.
The difference is Spiros says that it was never a stunt to make money from it. He says, I ran a small, at that time, small filmmaking business, you know, doing pop videos and, you know, a camera crew for hire, that kind of thing. And it was a bit of a stunt to say, let's release it. And then in 6 months' time, hold our hands up and say, this is how we made it, aren't we good? In the hope that they would, you know, get some more work, get some publicity. But Santilli kept claiming he'd spent some money on a piece of film with his old cameraman and he had to get his money back. So it was Santilli who actually sold it to the broadcasters and so on. And it's only at a much later date, you know, Spiros and his crew said, okay, fair enough. Not interested in UFOs anyway. They just carried on about their business. And it was only some years later that when they had a look at what had happened to the film and how much money had been made from it, which was considerable, I can assure you, that, you know, people started to come forward. And, you know, I've been to Spiros's home. I've seen his diaries for the time, his research files. He's got all kinds of materials. He even painted his own storyboard. Joe, he's quite a good artist. So he made up a story and painted his own storyboard.
Oh, my God.
So unfortunately, it is a hoax.
Yeah.
But I don't think we have the time to tell the whole story, but there's a huge story behind it of how it was made and who did this and who did what and, you know, funny things happened.
I bet that was quite a production to make it because, I mean, I thought it was real. I wished it was real.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the biggest critics of it at the time, his name will mean nothing to you, but it was an airline pilot. He was called Kent Jeffrey, and he was involved in UFO research in the USA. And he wrote a big scathing article about it in the US. However, he still thought the film was real.
Oh,
but
really?
He thought that the creature you see on it was some kind of deformed human being.
Yeah.
That they manipulated into this alien autopsy film. So even though he said it's not from Roswell, it's not an alien, it's still a real film. So even those that were, you know, a skeptical, there was a number of them that still thought it could well be real. So, and then, like I said, even, you know, all these years later, there are those today that still say, no, you know, Spiros is being a paid disinformant. And the film is authentic. It really did happen. And no matter what you tell them, no matter what you show them, Joe, they simply won't believe you. And in fact, just by coincidence, although Spiros made the film, it wasn't his original idea. Someone else, a couple of years before that, came up with the idea. And I've literally been speaking to him today. And it was just one of those things. And you know, there's still documentaries being made. There's still, I've heard that, you know, on the grapevine, there may even be a movie in the pipeline. I can't confirm that. But, you know, it's only just last year in America, you know, they celebrate Halloween much more than we do.
Yeah.
Some of them were having Halloween parties and they baked a cake. And the cake was the alien autopsy. There you have the creature on a slab. And when you cut it open, they've got all, you know, we call it jelly. They've got jam inside it, and that's the blood, you know. So they make alien autopsy cakes. There's models of it in a museum in Japan. So it's still out there. It appeared on The X-Files. It appeared on Seinfeld, The Simpsons. And a whole, so it's firmly ingrained now in popular culture, Joe. So whether you believe it's real or not, it's never going to go away.
No. I suppose that, you know, has damaged people's thoughts about UFOs. You know, it's all hoaxes and stuff like that. There'll be people out there that think the whole thing's a hoax, you know, like all of UFOs. There's lots of people that don't believe, aren't there?
Well, there is. I mean, but the way I look at this is to say, well, yes, there are hoaxes, but not just in this subject. Pretty much every subject you can think of.
Yeah.
You know, I'm pretty sure if you were a stamp collector, they have, you know, a similar type of thing.
Yeah.
It's not that many years back, of course, where we had the fake Hitler diaries. And they were published in the Times, you know. So, you know.
There's lots of and fake artwork, you know, it's all around.
Absolutely. So hoaxing is part of life. It's not just part of UFO research. And it's like saying, well, this Picasso I've got on my wall, it's a fake, it's a hoax. That doesn't mean that all Picassos are a fake, of course.
Exactly.
So, yeah, so there you go.
You publish UFO books.
Mm-hmm.
How did that all start?
Well, I mean, I co-authored my first book myself back in 1994.
Yeah.
And it was always difficult, even though I've been involved in just about anything and everything, to get your work into publication. And of course, come the digital age, that all changed. So in 2015, I've been a magazine editor and a whole host of things, Joe. A colleague of mine in Poland, believe it or not, he'd written a number of articles for a magazine I used to edit. And he sent me a manuscript that he'd written, not for publication, but for me to read. He speaks very good English, but he was wanting to practice his written English. So one of the ways he did that was he wrote this manuscript, and he wanted my opinion, not on what the manuscript entailed, but how good his English was.
Yeah.
So I gave him some feedback, and this sat in my inbox in email for quite some time. And a friend of mine called John Hansen, who lives in the Midlands, he'd already started his own little company called Haunted Skies, and he publishes his own book. So he told me how I could do it myself. So I looked into it. It wasn't, on the surface that difficult. Yeah. So I set up what I call Flying Disc Press. And the first book I published was my friend Peter's from Poland, and it was UFOs over Poland. I made some mistakes, first try, but it was well received. It's now also been published in a number of other languages as well. And that set me on the path of publishing not just my own books, but books by colleagues from around the world. And at that point, I used to work for a bank, and please don't hold that against me. So I took the plunge and took early retirement, and I work on Flying Disc Press full time.
How fantastic. That is it.
That's what I do. So we're literally, I've just published a book from a Japanese academic on UFOs. It's about an incident that happened in 1803 in Japan.
Really? How fantastic.
Yeah, and that literally came out yesterday. So,
what's that called?
It's called, you'll have to excuse my Japanese.
Yeah.
But it's Japan's ancient UFO, and it's called the Utsuro Bune.
Oh, how fun. So that's in English then?
Oh, yeah, in English.
It's just check it's not Japanese.
Yeah, it's about an account where this object landed off the shore somewhere in Japan in 1803, and this strange white woman, not Oriental, emerged from it holding a box, and she spoke a language they couldn't understand. So there's the whole story in there. They actually made some paintings of it at the time, Joe.
Really?
These paintings are housed in various institutions within Japan, which we had to get permission to duplicate, which we have, no problem. And they're all featured in there. So you can make up your own mind. And, it was only out a day, and I've already had an inquiry about the film rights to it. Really? I don't know whether that will come to anything, but it's nice to have the inquiry anyway.
Yeah, but that's fantastic.
Next book, which I've just been finished off the editing, that'll be out in November. Mm. That's from Brazil.
Really?
Yeah, and it's called UFO Contacts in Brazil. So it's a huge book. It's 500 plus pages, and it is a history of the best and most interesting UFO accounts in Brazil from the pre-1930s right the way through to today. And there is everything, anything and everything you can think of in it. That's a colleague of mine. Get it? Of course, it's in English.
Yeah.
But we've also said...
Because I had my sighting in Brazil.
There you go.
I was in Recife. Yeah. They have lots of sightings there, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been involved in quite a lot of things, and I think I've read it all. But I was rereading this book again while I was editing it, and I'm thinking, this is just amazing, So we've also set up Flying Disc Press LATAM. Mm. That's short for Latin America. Ah. So I have a colleague in Argentina who is now publishing all of our books in Spanish.
Oh, how amazing. That's fantastic.
Yeah, so, you know, I also...
And you've got a book by Calvin Parker on the a famous abduction.
That's right, yeah. I mean...
I don't know about that abduction.
Well, the story happened on October the 11th in 1973 at a place called Pascagoula in Mississippi.
Yeah.
Now, Calvin was 19, almost 19. He just moved to live with a friend of his father's. This chap was called Charles Hickson. Mm. And Charles was a foreman in the shipyard. They were shipbuilders. He'd only actually worked there one day at Calvin. So him and Charlie were driving home at night, and they drove by the river. This is not an out-of-the-way spot, Joe, you know. And they were both keen fishermen. So they said, well, after dinner tonight, we'll go and do a spot of fishing. So it was about 9 o'clock in the evening. They drove down to the river.
Yeah.
Calvin passed this no entry sign. That kind of worried him. Anyway, they were fishing for a while, like most fishermen, that you never caught anything. And from behind them came these blue lights. Now, Calvin's reaction was, I knew we shouldn't have been here. You know, it's the police.
Yeah.
So they both turned round. Well, of course, it wasn't this. It was police. It was a large object that was shaped like a rugby ball with lights on one end. The lights from it then were blinding. This opening appeared. It stopped just a couple of feet above the ground. These three creatures emerged from this opening and literally floated across the ground. Didn't walk, floated.
Oh, my God.
Two got hold of Charlie, one got hold of Calvin, and Calvin said he felt some kind of prick in his arm. He was convinced he'd been given some kind of sedative because he calmed down. He was terrified to begin with. They took them on board. This object from the ceiling went around them as if it was scanning them or taking x-rays or photographs. They were eventually dumped back on the pier, and initially they said, we can't tell anybody. They'll think we're crazy, you know.
Yeah.
So they set off, but they had a change of heart. So they pulled into a local store to use the payphone. First of all, they phoned the local airbase at Keesler. They weren't interested. They said, ring the sheriff. So they rang the sheriff's office. The sheriff said, stay, where are you? Stay there. We'll come and get you. And the first thing they did was give them a sobriety test, you know, like in America, walk in a straight line, touch
yeah.
your nose. Yeah, so they weren't drunk. They took them into the sheriff's office in Pascagoula, interviewed both gentlemen separately, and then put them together in a room. And they were sitting next to a desk. And unbeknown to Charlie and Calvin, in the desk drawer was a tape recorder playing. So they left them alone for 5 or 10 minutes, then went back and took the tape out of the drawer. They couldn't see it. They didn't know there was any tape there. The sheriff and his deputies played it back and thinking, we'll have them now. But, of course, they didn't.
Yeah.
They're still terrified on this tape. They're still talking about how they're going to tell their families, what they're going to do, you know. The story leaked out. And the next day, they were just bombarded by the press. And the following day, a very famous person in UFO research arrived on the scene. And that was Dr. J. Allen Hynek, the man who invented the phrase close encounters and worked with Spielberg on the movie.
Yeah.
He was also the scientific advisor on Project Blue Book, which was the United States Air Force official UFO study. He came with another gentleman called Dr. James Harder. They both interviewed Parker and Hickson and so on. And before they left, they had a press conference and said, these gentlemen are the genuine article. Now, Charlie Hickson, the older of the two, he went public, you know, he did lectures, he appeared on television. Calvin, 3 weeks later, had a nervous breakdown.
Oh my
he was
God.
The opposite. He ran away from it. Can you remember the old TV series, The Hulk?
Where yes.
Every time the media caught up with him, he'd move on to the next town.
Yeah.
Well, that was Calvin. He did exactly the same.
Really?
Yeah, but just over a year ago, you know, I contacted him looking for an interview. Charles Hickson died in 2011.
Yeah.
And it took me a number of months then to find him. And when I did find him, he wasn't, you know, overly fond of talking. But unknown to me, his wife had said, you know, why don't you write your own book, Calvin, and tell the story finally. And so he'd already had the idea in his head. So, hey, presto, last year we wrote, Calvin wrote the book. It's called Pascagoula, The Closest Encounter. Became an Amazon bestseller. Calvin has done some TV and he's literally speaking at a UFO convention this week in Phoenix, Arizona. And he signed up with a producer, so hopefully the movie will get made. And we're even working on a follow-up book. Since Calvin came out of the woodwork, so to speak, and told his own story, we've had others come forward, Joe, and say, well, in actual fact, I saw that thing on that night. You know, one lady was on the opposite bank of the river. She saw it. Another chap was working in the shipyard in a crane. He saw it, and so on. So we found so much more information that book number two is almost done.
Isn't that fantastic? You know, I think when people speak out, more and more people feel more comfortable about talking about their own experiences, don't they?
Well, that's it. I mean, there were a number of people had wanted to speak to Calvin for years to tell him what they'd seen that night, but they could never find him. They didn't know where he was, you know. You couldn't find him online. He had no online presence at all. I was only fortunate that he'd done an interview several years back, and I spoke to the gentleman who interviewed him, and he said, I've still got his email. You know, you can have that, try that. And luckily, he kept the same email address for a number of years. That's how I managed to find him.
Oh, my goodness. And,
so we've become firm friends. I mean, literally, today, a gentleman from Alabama in 1973, just a couple of nights after Charlie and Calvin's encounter, he had a UFO sighting, and he filmed it on 8mm film. Really? And he sent me the film. And it arrived today, and I've literally put it in the post to a company here in the UK to have it digitized to see if there's any images on it. So let's see what.
Yeah, how interesting that must be.
So, like I say, we've made a documentary about it that'll be released in January, I believe. The third draft of the screenplay has been written about Calvin's encounter. I've been allowed to read it. I'm not involved with it, but I've been allowed to read it. And if it makes it to the big screen, it will be a real treat.
Yeah, that
would
be. So
fingers crossed.
Fabulous.
And more people are coming forward and saying, well, we all saw something on that night as well.
Gosh, that's amazing. So do you think that is your most favourite UFO case?
It's certainly one of them.
I can imagine, yeah.
But there's another one that's not famous, but to me it's equally fascinating because happened in the early 1980s. Now, this area where I live, Joe, used to be a big coal mining area. My father worked down the coal mines all his life.
Yeah.
So in the early 80s, I got a call from a lady just up the road from where we lived. It's a little town called Normanton. And she told us about this UFO landing. So myself and Mark Birdsall, my colleague, interviewed her. She wasn't alone. She'd also seen it with four of her children. And it was a bright summer's afternoon. The children were playing out in the street. They were playing a ball game, the same ball game I used to play when I was their age.
Yeah.
The ball went up in the air, and they saw this thing descend, stop in the air, and then just drop to the ground. They lived in a cul-de-sac. At the end of the cul-de-sac was some trees and a little stream and some electricity pylons, and it was there. So they run in, mum, this thing's landed. Now, it was an elevated house, so you walked up the front steps to get in the house. So she came out, and she could see across these fields. And when she first filmed me, she's words were, you won't believe me, you won't believe me, you won't believe me. And, well, give me a chance. So she got the children, decided to go and take a closer look. And at one point, they go down a little dip and up, and she lost sight of it. And they come up the other side, and the field in which it was in is bordered by a fence. Now, this thing was still there, but now there were three tall humanoids with white suits on, a visor. They were so close they could see they weren't wearing gloves, they were wearing mittens, you know, and big boots. And the children weren't fazed by this at all, but she stopped them from climbing the fence. These three beings went behind this thing. It rose back up and took off into a clear blue sky. And she was amazed, obviously. We even interviewed one of the children's friends. He'd actually gone home for lunch and he'd missed it. When he came back, he'd missed all the excitement.
Oh, my God.
What baffled her, though, Joe, is this was a busy housing estate. Normanton is bordered by two motorways. There's the M1 on one side, there's the M62 right next to it.
Yeah.
And nobody else came forward. And she can't understand
why she was the only one that saw it.
She thought, it must be, you know, I'll sit down and it'll be on the TV news tonight, you know, nothing. And we've run several articles about this in the local media down the years, and nobody. And what also impressed me about this lady is, of course, you know, she was the same kind of person I'd grown up with. Her husband worked down a local coal mine at the time. They're all gone now, but so the children reminded me just of me when I was their age. You know, I played the same ball game. So they were saying, I know it's not scientific, but these were the same people that I'd grown up with all my life.
Yeah.
And she was either there was no chance of her misidentifying a helicopter or anything like that. So he was either lying or they were telling the truth. And I could find no reason why they were telling a lie.
Yeah, why would kids lie about something like that? And why would the mother? She didn't want the publicity, obviously.
No, I mean, she only got my telephone number because I'd done a feature in the local newspaper and it ran my telephone number.
Yeah.
And she saw that and phoned me. And wouldn't allow me to take a photograph, of course, because she had her curlers in at the time when we went to interview her, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm... You know, it's one of those cases you'll not read in any books or anything like that, but it was right on my doorstep, and it's one that continues to fascinate me today. I'd love to find the children now that they're grown up and look back at it and see what they think about it now. But I've attempted to do that, but I've not managed to track them down, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I wonder where they are. If they still remember, I'm sure they would.
They do, because I did find someone some years back that actually knew one of them. I think he'd either gone to school with them or had done something with them. And he says he told me all about it, Philip, you know. So they certainly did remember it, because they weren't little kids, you know. They were 8, 9, 10 year old.
Oh, they'll definitely remember.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something that a kid wouldn't forget.
No, it'd be ingrained on their memory forever.
Gosh, you are busy, aren't you, Philip?
Well, I try to be.
Yeah.
You know, I do this, you know, full time now. So, you know, if I'm not researching or writing about it, I've been trying to write my own book, another book of my own.
Yeah.
But that keeps getting derailed because, you know, other things take priority.
Well, I'm definitely going to get your Japanese book and the Calvin Parker one. I can't wait to read that. Where can I find and where can people find your books? On Amazon?
They're all on Amazon. And if you just pump in Flying Disc Press, disc with a K, in Google, you'll find me. I've got a little blog. There's links there to all the books, you know, going back over the last few years. They're all there.
Oh, fantastic.
Just have a look on Amazon.
Oh, that's fantastic, Philip. And thank you so much. I love talking to you. That's a really interesting, fascinating stories that you've got.
Well, maybe you should speak to Calvin one day personally, Joe.
Yeah. He
tell you his story from the very beginning and everything that happened to him. How's that for you?
That would be absolutely fantastic. I'd love to talk to him too.
All right. Well, I'm sure we can arrange that.
Yay! Philip, it's been so, I'm not going to take any more of your busy day. It's been so lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Joe. And you have a nice day, love.
All right. Send my love to Yorkshire.
Bye-bye now.
All right. Bye. Bye. That's our show for today. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please rate us on whatever platform you get your podcast from. It helps people like you find us. Today's show was produced by Mike Hansen for Pod People Productions. Associate producer Colette Cooper, and recorded at Hackenbacker Studios by Oliver Briley. Theme music by Mike Hansen and Jamie Allen. Special thanks to Nigel Heath and our narrator, Mike Hansen Sr. If you want to share your stories, we'd love to hear from you. Just email info@podpeopleproductions.co.uk, subject matter alien nation. Beam me up next time. I'm Joe Wood. And I believe.